Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Barack Obama goes back on the road. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Bipartisanship didn't work on Capitol Hill, but the massive stimulus bill passed anyway. Why did the president sign it in Denver? We'll look at the politics of economic recovery. Also on Which Way LA, the budget deal being worked out in Sacramento will have to be ratified by the voters. Will they agree to a spending cap and reverse themselves on school funding, mental health, and the state lottery? First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. As the budget stalemate continued in Sacramento, layoff notices went out to state workers today, and construction projects were shut down. Even if the political deadlock breaks, California's condition is likely to get worse. More on that at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. The $787 billion stimulus bill passed in less than 3 weeks of a new Democratic presidency with just 3 votes from Republicans, whose party was drubbed in the last 2 elections. After bipartisanship failed on Capitol Hill, President Obama took his show on the road with a stimulus bill signing ceremony today in Denver. Michael Shearer is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. And Michael, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure. Nice to be here.
What's the strategy here? Why sign this bill after all that has gone on in Washington in Denver?
Well, I think it's part of an approach that the White House has sort of recently turned to after spending the first several weeks in Washington and kind of buried in the minutia of the back and forth between the House and the Senate and the votes and the kind of intricacies of legislative back and forth. I think they realized after a time that that wasn't working so well and that the bipartisanship that they thought might have swept into the nation's capital after the election didn't happen exactly. And so he's going where he's comfortable, which is out, with the people where he gets sort of adoring crowds and can kind of make the point back to the Congress that, hey, the people that elected me still support me by large margins and they want this to happen. And so it kind of does two things. It gets him into a place where he's more comfortable, and it sends a message back to the sort of naysayers and the especially on the Republican side who oppose this, as you said, almost without exception, and sends a message to them that when they say no, that he's going to go to the people.
Is this something different from what other presidents have done? President Obama, like many, has run as an outsider, even though, of course, he was a United States a senator, and often during the campaign made the contrast between what people think in Washington and how they behave and what the rest of the country is all about. But all presidents do that from time to time. Does this appear to be something that's going to be different about the Obama administration?
I think we have to wait and see on that. I mean, I'm not entirely convinced that that this is all that different in terms of getting outside Washington. And, what tends to happen with presidents is that they find as the weight of the world and the United States and domestic issues and foreign policy comes down upon them, they find it more and more difficult to leave and to take those issues out to the public. It's, after all, not very necessarily very easy to debate or explain some of these issues in a town hall form. A lot of times these are intricate issues that, involve complicated negotiations and discussions. And so sometimes they don't easily boil themselves down into that kind of forum. So I think the jury is out on that one. He's clearly trying. I mean, he spent several days last week on the road. He's, was in Chicago over the weekend sort of taking some downtime. Now he's in 2 states and then goes to Canada. He will have hardly spent a day in the White House over the course of the last week. But, let's see how it goes.
Now, when he draws these adoring crowds, he apparently doesn't select them the way that the Bush people did or his people don't. Does he get Republicans there, too?
Well, that's an interesting question. I can't answer it for sure. I assume that he does. The way I've heard it described to me from the White House is that some of the people, I think I saw the number of something up to 30% or 40% of the people that tend to be at these things are invited guests. They are people, you know, there's a certain number of the tickets that are given to the, you know, to the White House offices that, you know, the political outreach offices that want to make sure that the local city councilmen and the local, you know, activists for the Democratic Party and others are invited. So there's a certain number of people that are clearly there, and you know, by design. They've said that something around 50% or 60% of the people are just, you know, tickets thrown open to whoever wants to come. And I suspect that there's got to be Republicans there. The crowd. I went to Florida with him last week for the day, and it was, you know, by and large, a very adoring crowd. I mean, there weren't any questioners that appeared to be harsh. Now, there probably were some people who were more skeptical in the audience and maybe didn't speak out.
Maybe we'll hear stories about the difficulty people have getting in. If they certainly don't have anti-Obama signs, that's for sure, and no doubt there's heavy security.
That's right.
At those events. Well, what about this business of the comfort level that the president himself has on the road? Obviously, some presidents do, some presidents don't, but he has a rapport with crowds that takes you back to Ronald Reagan.
Right, and I don't think anybody would be surprised by that, right? Having watched this guy on the campaign trail, even just as a regular kind of citizen of the country, watching him from afar, you'd have to come away with the impression that he makes a special connection with people when he's on that stage. It's actually probably his a greater gift even than his connection with people in a small room. You know, people used to say about Bill Clinton that the former president could walk into a room of 100 people and literally suck the oxygen out of it. He was so sort of charismatic in that kind of smaller group setting, people, everybody thinking that he's, you know, talking directly to them and all. There are people who make comparisons to Barack Obama in a small group, but I think much more so on the big stage. And so getting out in front of 1,500 people, 5,000 people. That's where he's most comfortable, and he chafed a bit, as most presidents do, when he first moved into the White House, realizing just how much of a gilded cage it really is, and that he can't go anywhere now without without this massive entourage. And so, you know, I think getting out into a small town, even though the entourage is still there with him, you know, there's a sense that maybe he's escaped for a day.
To what extent do you think he wants to escape and his staff wants him to escape, because there will be less concentration on the appointment failures and what appear to be some missteps very early in the administration?
Well, you know, certainly as a cynical reporter, there's a piece of me that thinks, you know, there's a little bit of no, look over here, not over there kind of aspect to it. I also think that even though, as you mentioned, he was a U.S. senator and he's no sort of stranger exactly to, you know, to Washington as a whole, I think the extent to which when you are the president and you are there in that building with the sort of White House reporters who have, you know, covered administrations for years, that everything seems to revolve around a very small, narrow discussion that sort of focuses on what does the White House say, and then quickly the reaction from the Republicans on the Hill, and then back and forth to what the White House said again. And it's a very sort of narrow discussion. And I think, you know, and those discussions, as you mentioned, sort of focused over the first couple of weeks on screw-ups in the nomination process and tax problems that some of his nominees had. And so, you know, their sense is you get him out of that environment and put him in front of a crowd, and the reporters have sort of little choice but to suddenly focus somewhere else.
And take pictures of all those people cheering and smiling. Indeed. And trying to get signatures. Michael Scheer, it's good to have you with us, and thanks very much for your time.
Certainly.
White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Let's talk a bit about the Republicans. Jacob Heilbrun is a journalist. He's senior editor at The National Interest and a contributor to The Huffington Post. He's author of a new book, They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. Jacob Heilbrun, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
How do you take the Republicans here, once again, giving him only 3 votes in the entire Congress for this massive program, said to be the biggest thing since the Great Depression? What are they risking by their opposition?
Well, the danger for the Republicans, who showed incredible discipline as a minority party in not voting for the stimulus package, is that the economy turns around in about a year. And Barack Obama will go on the campaign trail in 2010 and relentlessly emphasize that he had to restore the American economy, not only without the assistance, but with the active opposition of the Republican Party, that they would have derailed the recovery that he created. And it could prove devastating for the party in 2010, which would run counter-cyclical to historical trends, which is that the governing majority party always loses in an off year.
On the other hand, this economic crisis appears to be such that it could last a lot longer than 2010. Are the Republicans gambling that if that happens, then they're looking pretty good?
Yes, they are. And it's certainly possible that that could happen. I would still say that the stimulus will either avert the worst or help. But if Obama has 2 years to show progress, and if he doesn't, the Republicans will then pound him mercilessly for having failed to restore the economy. And in fact, they will argue that his stimulus package exacerbated rather than solved the problems that the country faces.
Did he make a mistake, do you think, with the effort at bipartisanship?
No. That was his campaign promise, and he absolutely had to pursue it. And I think the problem was that it became an end in itself during the stimulus package negotiations, and obviously Obama was naive and had miscalculated the extent of opposition that he would face. But I don't think he can just throw it overboard, and I don't think he will in the future either. When the other problems that the country faces, I think he is going to make an attempt at bipartisanship. But I think it'll be a much more sober view, and the euphoria that he had in the first weeks in office is gone.
En route to Chicago last weekend, the president talked about bipartisanship on Air Force One, and he said, "I'm an eternal optimist, but I'm not a sap." Here's a more extensive comment. He made this in New Hampshire just before the 2007 presidential primary, and he was talking about how he works with the opposition.
I am always best as a counterpuncher. You know, if somebody comes at me, I will knock them out. Mm-hmm. If not, then I will try to understand their point of view. And that actually serves me well. I give people the benefit of the doubt. I try to understand their point of view. If I perceive that they try to take advantage of that, then I will crush them.
Barack Obama talking before the New Hampshire primary in 2007. Byron York is chief political correspondent at the Washington Examiner. That's a new conservative outlet in Washington. And Byron York, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Good to be here.
Good to be with you. What about this? Are the Republicans, have they laid themselves open to being crushed?
Well, they have. Actually, there was always a division of opinion inside Republicans about how to handle the stimulus thing. First of all, losing everything, losing the House, losing the Senate, and losing the White House, gave them some freedom to get back in touch with their values. And a lot of them were actually offended, or let's say they strongly opposed a lot of the spending measures in the stimulus bill. They thought they were either porky and wasteful, or they thought they were legitimate spending measures for a federal government to undertake, but they didn't belong in the stimulus bill. So they had real opposition. But there was always this feeling amongst a number of them that after they made their points with pointing out some of the sometimes silly spending parts of the bill, they needed to pivot and to push their own plan and to talk about tax cuts, to talk and to try to make clear that they did support things like extending unemployment coverage, things like that. But I think it's fair to say that they didn't have as much success pushing their own plan as they did poking holes in the stimulus. So they got a good run, but of course they lost because they're so heavily outnumbered.
What about the history of the past 8 years when it comes to tax cuts and the condition we see the economy in now, not to mention the deficit, given the kind of spending that went on during the Bush administration? Do Republicans still have credibility in that area?
Well, first of all, some of them do, always did. Leaders like Tom Coburn, the senator from Oklahoma, or Mike Pence, the representative from Indiana, some of them feel like they have had credibility all the way through. A number of them lost a lot of their credibility in the Bush administration because they sort of worked hand in glove and didn't pay much attention to spending during that time. On the other hand, you know, most of the time in the Bush administration, when you're talking about spending issues and Republicans not exercising control, Democrats in Congress were actually usually exerting pressure to spend even more. So it's not as if anyone at this point has a whole lot of credibility on the spending issue. And I think certainly given the emergency nature that's in everyone's mind about the stimulus bill, deficits just went out the window. I mean, they're talking about spending $1 trillion, and, you know, none of it is supported by tax revenues. So the deficits have just concern about them has gone out.
What do you think about this signing ceremony out in Denver?
Well, I think it's a smart thing for Obama to do. Because he did get a lot of success. Republicans were beating him up pretty hard in the early days of the stimulus battle, and he really began to get some success when he went out to Elkhart, Indiana, and talked about it, the RV capital of the country. When he went down to Florida talking about it, he got his traction back when he went out in the country and began to talk about this. So I think this is a continuation of what worked for him in the battle.
You've written, though, that there's a kind of hypocrisy in this, that when there was an emergency bill, the first bills came down that were not emergencies, he signed them right away, and this, which was supposed to be such an emergency, he's waited 4 days to sign.
Well, you know, it was an odd thing because the article you're referring to in Examiner Politics, it was about something called Sunlight Before Signing. Which was an Obama campaign pledge in which he said that too often bills are rushed through Congress and to the president's desk without the public getting a chance to examine them. Imagine that. And he said because he didn't think that was a good idea, he pledged to put a bill up on the White House website for 5 days. And then the very first bill that's passed, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, he signs it a couple of days after it's passed, never puts it on the website. And then the next bill is the S-CHIP expansion, the Children's Health Insurance expansion. He signs that within hours and never puts it on the website. And then, now those are probably non-emergency bills. And then with the stimulus bill, which could be classified as an emergency bill, he heads off to Chicago for a few days. You know, Saturday passes, Sunday passes, Monday passes, and it's not until Tuesday with this big kind of campaign-style event in Denver that he signs the bill. So it's just one odd little corner of the Obama presidency so far is that he has just really not paid any attention to that particular campaign promise.
Jacob Halperin, a quick response to you, again, senior editor at the National Interest.
Well, I think it's interesting what Byron was saying earlier about the issue of deficits and the Republicans, because it was Vice President Dick Cheney who memorably said that deficits don't matter early on in the first Bush term. So I think Byron is right to point to Tom Coburn and a few others in the GOP who sought to curb the deficit. But really, as he points out, neither party does have that much credibility on the issue.
You're not impressed by this argument about openness in the White House website?
Well, it sounds like I don't. You know, what strikes me is I was surprised by the lack of professionalism and the sheer ineptitude of the Obama administration in its first weeks. It sounds to me, I mean, what I think Byron's point is probably a fairly minor one, but it may be emblematic of a White House operations that are simply not up to snuff yet. I was frankly taken aback by how badly they bungled the appointments and the lack of professionalism that they exhibited. It was a stark contrast, actually, to the first weeks of Bush's first term when he got off to a very fast start.
Jacob Halperin again with the National Interest, Byron York with the Washington Examiner. Jay Cost is the creator of the Horse Race blog at realclearpolitics.com. He's been listening to our conversation. And Jay Cost, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
How do you think it looks to Americans to have the president leave Capitol Hill, as we have heard described, because he feels more comfortable or for whatever reason, and go out on the hustings to do something as important as signing this stimulus bill and then introducing a package in about home foreclosure in Phoenix?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that for starters, it looks different. I mean, this is not something that George W. Bush typically did, certainly not this frequently and certainly not early in his presidency. And I think it remains to be seen because, you know, I don't think we've had enough time for the American public to digest the idea of an active campaigner-in-chief And we'll see. You know, it's a tricky move that the Obama administration is adopting here, in that there's political risks inherent to it. You know, much of the president's power is not formal. The Constitution, Article 2, is a very, very narrow, you know, list of powers that the president actually has, and so a lot of it's informal, which means a lot of it depends upon public perception of the president and the sense of awe, if you will, that people get around the president. And so I think that what the Obama administration has been doing this week and the week before it is sort of cashing in on the awe that the country currently has for him in this office. He seems very powerful and, you know, hitting the stump like he is to push his legislative agenda through. I think in the short run, it's been very beneficial to him. But in the long run, I think it remains to be seen. You know, I mean, this is just not something we've seen before, really.
So people might run out of awe, or the president could spend his awe too quickly?
Yeah, that's well put. You know, I mean, what you don't want to have happen, for instance, is a series of campaign gaffes, you know, campaign-style gaffes when you're on the stump. You know, those tend to be less scripted, and you know, the opportunity for embarrassment sort of creeps in. But also, I think that, you know, more broadly, this is a sort of acknowledgement, I think, of a trend in the country that we've been moving to over the last couple of years, closer and closer toward the idea of a permanent presidential campaign. And, you know, I mean, I would note that, you know, John Kerry actually declared his intentions in 2002, at the end of 2002, to run for president in 2004. Barack Obama declared his intention in January of 2007. So I think what the White House is doing here is acknowledging, in a lot of respects, that the presidential campaign doesn't really end. But the gamble they're taking, I think, is injecting the president himself into this permanent campaign more actively. And I think it remains to be seen how the country's going to approach that.
Is it possible that we talk about this sense of awe? You're suggesting then that it seems that he loses that. He loses a kind of a credibility. Is that the right term when he goes out? Or does he become too familiar?
Well, I think that I think the idea here is that it's a possibility. You know, campaigning is sort of very different from, you know, the actual act of governing. You know, and when the president is in the White House and he's sort of surrounded by the imagery of the White House and the song hail to the chief, you know, there's a certain statesmanlike quality to it that, you know, is difficult to carry over onto the campaign trail. Campaign trail is grittier, earthier. It's, you know, you just sort of run risks about, you know, how does the president look as a campaigner, you know, and campaigning is something that I think, all in all, the American public is fairly ambivalent on. I don't think that the transition that we've been undertaking toward this permanent campaign is something that the country as a whole is satisfied with.
Again, Jay Cost is creator of the Horse Race blog at RealClearPolitics.com. Let me go back to our other commentators. Byron York, chief political correspondent now at the Washington Examiner, once again, new conservative outlet in Washington. What's your take on what we've heard since the last time we talked with him?
Well, you know, I think it is theoretically possible for Barack Obama to be overexposed right now, but we're just not there yet. This is a very, very big fight. Republicans showed unexpected unity. They were very sharp in their criticisms, landed a lot of blows against the stimulus. And Obama says, you know, I'm a guy who can go out and get a crowd of 50,000 people, you know, just snapping my fingers. And it was very tempting for him to do, and it was very effective. It helped really turn his fortunes around on the stimulus, although they were always going to win because they have 256 votes in the House and 58 votes in the Senate, so it was going to win. So, you know, I think that at some point he could overdo it, but not so far.
Jacob Heilbrun, back to you with the National Interest. Let me talk or raise another question about Ronald Reagan. People used to say about him that polls showed that they liked his liked him, but they didn't like his policies. He did very well, obviously, but I wonder if there's a comparison here that holds up.
Well, the situation is a little different because when Reagan came into office, the economy hadn't yet gone into recession. So I think there is broader support for Obama's policies, particularly among the swing voters, than there might have been for Reagan. But Reagan's approach when he went for his tax package was to stump the country. And in a sense, that's what Obama is doing now. He is kind of channeling Ronald Reagan by going out and showing to Congress that he has the voice of the people behind him. And as far as Obama Yes, his charismatic personality has, of course, won over a lot of people. But I don't think that this discrepancy between personality and policy will last. The one thing that Obama will be measured upon is unemployment figures. And Reagan's popularity went down as well when the economy tanked, and then it came back in 84, just as the economy did.
So, Jay Kost, it's always the economy. Stupid, how long do you think Obama has to go out on the hustings and make these kinds of appearances, demonstrate that he's able to produce this sense of awe before that's going to begin to look pretty old if the economy isn't getting better?
Yeah, that's the question. I mean, I don't think we can put an answer on it just yet. And I mean, I think that when we're talking about Obama on the stump, I would suggest that it's a risk. But that doesn't necessarily mean this is a bad thing. I think that this is more of an innovation. At least in recent political history, we haven't seen presidents do something like this. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether or not in the long run it'll be effective or ineffective. But I think that your suggestion is generally accurate, that, you know, this is going to become a problematic political tool for him if he's seen on the stump campaigning as the economy continues to falter.
Well, Jay Kost, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Thanks to Jay Kost of the Horse Race blog at realclearpolitics.com, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Jacob Heilbrun of the National Interest, and Michael Shear of the Washington Post. In a moment, the best guess at what California might get from the federal stimulus package and what Sacramento's budget deal will ask of state voters if and when it ever passes on Which Way L.A. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. Despite today's dramatic signing in Denver, it is not at all clear just who will get what from the $787 billion stimulus package. Robert Hodekainen reports from Washington for the McClatchy newspapers, including the Sacramento Bee. And Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, nice to be with you.
I guess the big question in Sacramento is, with a $42 billion deficit, can any of this federal money go directly to deal with that?
Well, everybody is trying to scramble here in Washington to figure out how this money can be spent, and a lot of it does come attached with strings. We know for sure that California will get about $5 billion for what's called the New State Fiscal Stabilization Fund. And that money is intended to help states balance their budgets. California is not alone. There's more than 40 states that need help balancing their budgets.
Not because costs are up alone, but because taxes are down, in part because of the economic problems.
Yes, exactly.
So there's $5 billion for that. Roughly, do you suppose that California would get how much?
Well, according to my calculations, let's see, the overall bill is $787 billion, two-thirds spending and one-third tax cuts. California is the biggest winner among the states simply by virtue of its size, and it looks like California will receive a minimum of $26 billion. But it really depends, because no one knows how much individual states will receive in various grant categories. So states will be applying for those, and it could be months or even longer before this plays out and we know the final numbers.
Now, can cities and counties also apply by themselves for some of this federal assistance?
I think the rules are, I know for the education piece, some of the education money will be going directly to the schools. I don't know for sure how they resolve the all the regulations dealing with cities and counties. Back to the total, I just wanted to say that Senator Feinstein's office is estimating that California will receive about $34.5 billion. That was in their fact sheet. And let's see, we also have an estimate from the Center for American Progress that says California could receive as much as $64 billion if you include the value of the tax cut.
There's an extraordinary range here, then, from your $26 billion up to $64 billion from the Center for American Progress, an enormous amount of uncertainty.
Yes, exactly. And it's because everybody's counting different pots of money. And, I mean, this bill is massive, and there's money going to so many different programs. And as I said, it'll take a while to shake out.
The president said today that there's going to be accountability for every penny that gets spent. I would think the accountability itself would be a very expensive proposition.
Well, I would guess so, too. I was looking at some of the accountability provisions today, and as you know, anytime the federal government gives out money, they like to attach a few strings. With the education money, for example, states have to promise that they will support elementary, secondary, and public post-secondary education at least at the levels in fiscal year 2006. So if they try to cut beyond that, Uncle Sam will come knocking. And also with the transportation money, California will get about $2.5 billion to fix up its highways, roads, and bridges. So you should see the cranes and shovels moving very quickly. This is aimed at providing a quick jolt to the economy, and states that don't spend this money quickly enough will have to turn it back to Washington.
I wonder if California will have a problem because it's shutting down construction projects today because of the delay in the budget in Sacramento. It's already, I think it's at the end of the rope here. All the projects have been shut down, so it'll take them time to get them started up, and I suppose that might delay the application for money.
Well, I don't know. I know the governor's office, as early as January, put together a long list of shovel-ready projects. That's the new lingo in Washington. Everything has to be shovel-ready to apply for this money. And California had a very long list, so I don't think they'll have any problem spending the money.
What about unemployment? There are going to be various subsidies for that, as I understand it. It's going to be extended. Unemployment insurance will be extended. Food stamps.
Yes, it's going to be raised for the unemployed. In California, we have about 800,000 jobless. The maximum benefits right now are $450 a week in benefits. They'll be getting an extra $25 a week if they qualify. And the new maximum weekly checks are expected to pump about $981 million in benefits to the unemployed in California.
Help for Medicaid as well.
Yeah, Medicaid is a big-ticket item, $10 billion for the state of California. This is to help the state avoid additional cuts in Medi-Cal and other safety net programs. Education is a huge category, estimated to get 10% of the total federal funding, which is about $105 billion. $9.5 billion is directed at helping the cuts or helping school districts avoid big cuts. They'll be getting $1.5 billion for Title I, $1.2 billion for special education to help educate disabled students, and $82 million for Head Start and early Head Start to help low-income kids.
All right. We are beginning to go through a process that is going to take a long time, obviously, once again, with estimates ranging from $26 billion to $64 billion for California just at the outset. Uncertainty is the bottom line. And Rob Hodekainen, thanks a lot for helping us out.
Hey, pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
Washington Bureau correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers, including the Sacramento Bee. We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.?
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. 10,000 state workers and 275 construction projects are the latest casualties of the budget crisis in Sacramento. Layoff notices and orders to shut down went out today. Meantime, one Republican senator is still needed to pass a budget with $14 billion in new taxes, $15 billion in spending cuts, and $10 billion in borrowing. Dan Walters is a syndicated columnist for the Sacramento Bee. And Dan, always good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
We'll be talking about this. We're talking about this in the afternoon. We don't know what's going to happen this evening, but does it appear there's any chance this might pass today?
Well, I'm sitting in the state Senate chambers right now, and they had 2 hours of debate this morning on the, or this afternoon, I should say, on the most single most controversial element in the 27 bill package, and that is the tax measures, the sales, income, and gasoline taxes that would be raised by this package. And as was expected, the Democrats urged passage, and Republicans urged rejection. And then just before they were supposed to vote, they recessed and went into private caucuses And there are rumors here that there may be, in fact, some sort of a deal that would get that very elusive third Republican vote in the Senate. We already know that the measure and all the other measures will pass the Assembly. The only question has been in the Senate, and that's only been a question of having one more Republican senator. As you recall, it takes a two-thirds vote to pass something. There is one vacant seat because Mark Ridley Thomas departed for Los Angeles, and so it takes one more Republican vote than it otherwise would take because of his departure. And the pressure on a couple of those potential Republican senators over the last few days has been very heavy. Dave Cox from the Sacramento area and Abel Maldonado from the Central Coast, Santa Maria, have been the main targets. Cox got up on the floor and said basically he's not voting for it. We have yet to hear from Maldonado, who's been kind of all over the map. Some days he's kind of seems to be favorably disposed. The other days he said he won't vote for it. He made a very impassioned speech last night. He talked about the need for political reform, such as an open primary and legislators not getting pay raises during a recession and so forth. And something along those lines might be brewing to get his vote.
Abel Maldonado of Santa Maria also said, with regard to Governor Schwarzenegger, who has a lot at stake in all of this, where was he when I needed him?
There is an undercurrent of resentment by him that he stood up with Schwarzenegger against his fellow Republicans in the past, not only on the budget, but on carrying a minimum wage bill, for example, that most Republicans opposed. And that yet when Maldonado ran for statewide office in 2006 for state controller, Schwarzenegger didn't lift a finger to help him get the Republican nomination. In fact, he lost the nomination to Tony Strickland, who's now also a state senator here in Sacramento. And there's definitely a tone of hurt feelings, I guess you'd call it, or something in his voice. He wants some respect or something. I'm not sure. It's hard to tell what Maldo wants. That's why everybody calls him Maldo, because he tends to be all over the map. His desires and hopes and dreams or whatever kind of shift from day to day, so it's kind of hard to pin him down.
And in the meantime, the fiscal situation in the state gets worse and worse with every minute, really, every day, certainly, that the budget isn't passed. And yet it will rise or fall on this kind of consideration?
Yes, it will. I think the layoff notices and the shutdown of construction projects, that's more in the nature of trying to ramp up some pressure on the legislature rather than something that's going to have some material effect immediately. That I don't think those things really count for much in this whole thing. For example, the layoffs would take months to actually accomplish, even though the notices went out today. So it's all part of the game that's been going on here for the last week, ever since the agreement among the Big Five was announced to close this $40 billion deficit. There's been this kind of maneuvering back and forth and backroom negotiations, and they've bought off one senator after they got one Senate vote by promising his county $35 million more in state aid. That was Orange County. They got a Republican vote by fixing up a problem with one of his cities to let them keep more property taxes and not send it to Los Angeles County, the city of Glendora. And another senator signed on after they had adopted his proposal for a tax credit for buying new homes. And so it's been kind of that retail politics business going on all week, but they still lack that one vote, and the question is whether it will be Maldonado.
Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Tony Quinn is a former Republican staffer. He's a veteran Sacramento political consultant and co-editor of the California Target book. That's the most authoritative handbook on California's legislative and congressional districts, and it's always good, Tony Quinn, to have you on our program.
Thank you.
How would you explain this from a Republican point of view? What we keep hearing from them is that it's all about taxes. They have taken a pledge not to raise taxes, even though the revenue situation is what it is, and everybody agrees, even including some of the Republicans who won't vote for it, like Dave Cox, and we just heard about, that you couldn't possibly solve this problem just with cutbacks. So tell us, from a Republican standpoint, what's going on?
Well, actually, if you were simply to take the cuts, and the money that was just explained in the early report that's coming to the state as part of the stimulus package, and then a borrowing that the governor plans to do, you would cover about three-quarters of the needs, and that could be enacted, say, for a six-month budget, and then revisit the tax issue 6 months down the line, see if you actually need it. The reason that that doesn't have any political viability is that the Democrats are as much committed to tax increases as their very first item of business when it comes to dealing with this budget crisis, as the Republicans are opposed to it. much of this, the problem here is not really even the tax problem. The problem here is you no longer have a middle. You no longer have centrist legislators that can say, look, we know we got to do something, so you got to give up here, we got to give up there. What you have now, thanks to the gerrymandered districts and closed primaries and the influence of the interest groups with their huge independent expenditures and political campaigns, is you have people that are entirely beholden to the ideological base within their districts that got them elected. And they're simply not able to cross that base. For the Democrats, it's labor, it's the public employees, and for the Republicans, it's the anti-tax folks. And so they're just in two parallel different worlds.
So the Democrats, as you said their first priority was tax increases.
Right.
It's tax increases in order to maintain the programs that they support. It's not
That's right.
the increases in and of themselves.
The Democrats realize things are so bad that they've had to do some real major cuts. What I am kind of surprised at, and shows you how kind of the Republicans are not involved in the real debate, they've just been left out, is this budget deal does have some significant cuts in programs that the Republicans have thought had been growing far too much. And most importantly, it does have the rainy day fund, and it does have a mechanism that could provide a budget cap that would keep us out of this business of the spending going so much faster than the revenue flow. Those are Republican types of things. They're things Republicans pushed for that the Democrats pushed against, and yet the Democrats have given in on lots of that, and you still can't get the Republicans to bend.
Wasn't Governor Schwarzenegger supposed to end all of this and change the political landscape in Sacramento? Was that a hollow promise after all?
That was all a promise. The stupidest idea that Governor Schwarzenegger has had was the post-partisan world. The result of his post-partisan politics, and Dan mentioned it in mentioning how he failed to help any other Republicans in 2006, is the fact that he has no friends in the Republican caucus, and really he doesn't have any in the Democratic caucus either. All of our governors are members of political parties, and they've had to start with their own base and their own party, in part because Schwarzenegger got in through the recall, and in part because he got this strange notion that he was above partisan politics. He's unable to wield any partisan pressure, to exert any partisan pressure, and as a result, he's kind of left there all by himself.
Once again, we are talking about debate, about enormous cuts in the budget, as even Republicans concede, and increases in taxes, the sales tax by 1 cent per dollar, the vehicle license fee going up 12 cents a gallon increase for gasoline. But even if all of this passes, it's going to require at least five, authoritative counts, measures to go on the ballot and be approved by the voters. Joe Matthews is a student of these matters. He's an Irvine Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, contributor to the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and author of The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. Joe Matthews, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Let's start with these. Let's go down the list here. Five measures on what?
Oh, well, you for a variety of different things. I'm part of the plot here, and this actually goes back to the budget deal that was reached last September and was sort of wildly off in its projections, involves changes to the state lottery and some essentially borrowing against future lottery revenues. The lottery was enacted by ballot initiative, and thus you need to go back. We're this rare state where if you do something by ballot initiative, only the voters can change it.
So and very specifically in this case, the lottery originally was supposed to go only for education, and this would allow it to be spent for other purposes as well.
That's, yes, I mean, that's something of a simplification of what they're doing, but not wrong either. The other things that are being tweaked here are there are changes around Prop 98, the education funding guarantee. There's an attempt to go back into revenues, and this would be two different measures. One, a proposition, Prop 10, revenues sort of for early childhood programs.
Rob Reiner's famous initiative.
Right. And then Prop 63, which was a sort of a tax and revenue measure for mental health programs, Prop 63 in 2004, which was actually championed by the now Democratic Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg. And then the fifth would be this spending limit proposal that's part of the deal. That would get you to five measures.
Okay, now we're on early childhood. That's a tax on the cigarettes per pack. The mental health one you mentioned was referred to as the millionaire's tax because of the way that it's assessed. Voters would have to essentially reverse themselves, wouldn't they, in order to go along with what's being proposed?
Yeah, that's about right. They would. One of the interesting factors of this is both Prop 10 and Prop 63, as far as sort of targeted funding measures for a particular program, are very responsible measures because they actually included a funding mechanism, a tax. The irony is that the most responsible measures are the ones that are easiest to get back into because there's revenue for people to get in a tough budget time. Something like a Prop 71, the stem cell bond measure, is actually something we can't tap because there's actually no revenue sources. It's pure borrowing. So in that way, in sort of in direct democracy, the way this has worked, we're actually rewarding the irresponsible.
Joe Matthews of the New America Foundation. Back to Tony Quinn. Are there already campaigns being geared up to support and oppose these measures?
I think there are campaigns being geared up to oppose them. There's going to be labor interests and interests on the liberal side that do not want to get into those funds that Joe mentioned, that do not want this budget cap. There's just really a lot of opposition there. Unfortunately, on the Republican side, you're going to find that there's so much opposition to the taxes that they might end up not supporting the budget cap too. And the reason for that is if the budget cap fails, the taxes go away. They only stay in for 2 years, according to the latest version. And if these things pass, they are ineffective for 5 years. So if you want to kill off the tax increase and kill off the raid on all these programs and not have a budget cap at all, then you vote no on all of these things. And I can see the really dangerous situation where the left and the right gets together to oppose these for different reasons.
Dan Walters, you and I have talked about the dysfunctionality of government in Sacramento many, many times on this program, but this sounds like it's setting new records.
Yeah, it's pretty much a case study in dysfunction of having to go in and tweak the budget to provide money for one county or for one city or for one little pet project to try to get these votes. I suppose it's politics as usual, but like all these big ambitious sorts of things, when you start tweaking these things to have a political effect of some kind, you kind of usually wind up with some sort of an unworkable monstrosity. I mean, this whole thing is kind of a house of cards. It's depending on revenues that may not materialize because the economy is still going down. It's depending on spending cuts that may not be enough because the economy is going down. It's dependent on the voters buying something that many of them probably are not going to want to buy. It's dependent on trying to basically kind of trick people in a sense of way. As Tony mentioned, this extending the tax increases if the spending limit measure passes is a kind of a perverse, it was designed to keep the people on the left, particularly the unions, from opposing the measure, but it may have the effect of encouraging those on the right to oppose it instead. And you start getting too clever with all these things, you run the risk of the whole thing just kind of collapsing its own ponderous weight, and this may be the effect of this package, even if it's passed, there are so many moving parts to this thing that you can't even begin to predict whether it'll actually have the intended effect.
Joe Matthews, back to you. As a student of direct democracy, the initiative referendum and recall, what are we looking at here down the road, do you think, in terms of people's confidence in government? They're willing to put up with any more taxes at all, for example, even for things that they want to see money spent for?
Well, I think there's already polling that shows people After quite a bit of support for taxes as part of a budget solution, some of that support starting to slip a little bit. I think we have a fundamental problem that this points up, which has to do with that, you know, we have so much of our spending in our budget sort of controlled or influenced in some way by our initiative process, and we have an incredibly inflexible initiative process. It's very hard to change things that are done by initiative, and again, we also have, because of that, we actually have two budgets. We have the budget that lawmakers approve each year, and then we have the budget after voters, you know, throw in their priorities, bonds, geo bonds, spending programs, and those sorts of things. And the reason we have to go to voters is because essentially we have those two budgets, and they're both out of alignment. I think ultimately you have to look at changing the initiative process if you're ever going to get a handle on this, to make it essentially harder to do things, at least fiscal things, via initiative, and to also bring the legislature into the initiative process, at least when you're doing things that are budgetary, so they at least get a real say before voters do things.
Dan Walters, do you think there are people, potential demagogues, who are taking a look at this situation with the thought that, boy, I could really make some changes here if I'd got the right slogans and enough money to put something on the ballot?
There are always demagogues who hope to do that. Sometimes they're rich demagogues who can finance those measures themselves. Sometimes they're what I would call initiative entrepreneurs who use the direct mail and they have a little machine going, and the machine is dependent on dreaming up ever more initiatives so they can get people to pony up money. And it's not just demagogues. There are people in this for the money. And I'm going to tell you, there's an industry here. Passing ballot measures and opposing ballot measures made a lot of people rich.
So, Tony Quinn, it would appear things might get worse before they get better.
Yes, I actually don't think the initiative process needs to be changed as much as the legislature does. The people are very happy with the initiative process. If you try making any changes, they say no. But there is a movement afoot to bring us back to a part-time legislature on the grounds that they waste a lot of time, further restrict their ability to spend money. We're likely to have another battle at some point here over this two-thirds rule that requires two-thirds to pass the budget and to raise taxes. We had a ballot measure on that. That came out from the labor folks about 5 years ago, and that was shot down. So the change that I think is more likely is the public really getting good and mad at the legislature.
Okay, and in the meantime, of course, we'll look at the effect on services provided by the state of California and what it takes to pay for them. Thank you all very much. Tony Quinn, again, co-editor of the California Target book, a former Republican staffer, Dan Walters, with the Sacramento Bee, syndicated columnist, Joe Matthews at the Irvine Center, his book, The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy, Which Way L.A., produced tonight by Gary Scott, Katie Cooper, and Sonia Geis, managing producer Cameron Radziner, technical director Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.